This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of True Grit by Charles Portis, narrated by Donna Tartt, with an essay by Donna Tartt at the end of this program. This book is copyrighted 1968 by Charles Portis. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. 25 years have passed, and Matty Ross, in a voice strong and true, here tells how, in the winter of 1870-something, as a 14-year-old girl from Dardanelle, Arkansas, she rode out into Indian Territory to revenge the murder of her father. And now, True Grit.
People do not give it credence that a 14-year-old girl could leave home and go off in the wintertime to avenge her father's blood. But it did not seem so strange then, although I will say it did not happen every day. I was just 14 years of age when a coward, going by the name of Tom Cheney, shot my father down in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and robbed him of his life and his horse and $150 in cash money, plus 2 California gold pieces that he carried in his trouser band. Here is what happened. We had clear title to 480 acres of good bottom land on the south bank of the Arkansas River, not far from Dardanelle in Yale County, Arkansas. Tom Cheney was a tenant, but working for hire and not on shares. He turned up one day hungry and riding a gray horse that had a filthy blanket on his back and a rope halter instead of a bridle. Papa took pity on the fella and gave him a job and a place to live. It was a cotton house made over into a little cabin. It had a good roof. Tom Cheney said he was from Louisiana. He was a short man with cruel features. I will tell more about his face later. He carried a Henry rifle. He was a bachelor, about 25 years of age. In November, when the last of the cotton was sold, Papa took it in his head to go to Fort Smith and buy some ponies. He had heard that a stock trader there named Colonel Stonehill had bought a large parcel of cow ponies from Texas drovers on their way to Kansas and was now stuck with them. He was getting shed of them at bargain rates, as he did not want to feed them over the winter. People in Arkansas did not think much of Texas Mustang ponies. They were little and mean. They had never had anything but grass to eat and did not weigh over 800 pounds. Papa had an idea they would make good deer hunting ponies, being hardy and small and able to keep up with the dogs through the brush. He thought he would buy a small string of them, and if things worked out, he would breed and sell them for that purpose. His head was full of schemes. Anyway, it would be a cheap enough investment to start with, and we had a patch of winter oats and plenty of hay to see the ponies through till spring, when they could graze in our big north pasture and feed on greener and juicier clover than they ever saw in the Lone Star State. As I recollect, shelled corn was something under 15 cents a bushel then. Papa intended for Tom Cheney to stay and look after things on the place while he was gone. But Cheney set up a fuss to go, and after a time, he got the best of Papa's good nature. If Papa had a failing, it was his kindly disposition. People would use him. I did not get my mean streak from him. Frank Ross was the gentlest, most honorable man who ever lived. He had a common school education. He was a Cumberland Presbyterian and a Mason, and he fought with determination at the Battle of Elkhorn Tavern, but was not wounded in that scrap, as Lucille Biggers Langford states in her Yale County Yesterdays. I think I am in a position to know the facts. He was hurt in the terrible fight at Chickamauga, up in the state of Tennessee, and came near to dying on the way home from want of proper care. Before Papa left for Fort Smith, he arranged for a colored man named Yarnell Poindexter to feed the stock and look in on Mama and us every day. Yarnell and his family lived just below us on some land he rented from the bank. He was born of free parents in Illinois, but a man named Bloodworth kidnapped him in Missouri and brought him down to Arkansas just before the war. Yarnell was a good man, thrifty and industrious, and he later became a prosperous house painter in Memphis, Tennessee. We exchanged letters every Christmas until he passed away in the flu epidemic of 1918. To this day, I have never met anybody else named Yarnell, white or black. I attended the funeral and visited in Memphis with my brother, little Frank, and his family. Instead of going to Fort Smith by steamboat or train, Papa decided he would go on horseback and walk the ponies back all tied together. Not only would it be cheaper, but it would be a pleasant outing for him and a good ride. Nobody loved to gad about on a prancing steed more than Papa. I have never been very fond of horses myself, although I believe I was accounted a good enough rider in my youth. I never was afraid of animals. I remember once I rode a mean goat through a plum thicket on a dare. From our place to Fort Smith was about 70 miles as a bird flies, taking you past beautiful Mount Nebo, where we had a little summer house so Mama could get away from the mosquitoes, and also Mount Magazine, the highest point in Arkansas. But it might as well have been 700 miles for all I knew of Fort Smith. The boats went up there, and some people sold their cotton up there, but that was all I knew about it. We sold our cotton down in Little Rock. I had been there two or three times. Papa left us on his saddle horse, a big chestnut mare with a blazed face called Judy. He took some food and a change of clothes rolled up in some blankets and covered with a slicker. This was tied behind his saddle. He wore his belt gun, which was a big, long dragoon pistol, the cap and ball kind that was old-fashioned even at that time. He had carried it in the war. He was a handsome sight, and in my memory's eye, I can still see him, mounted up there on Judy in his brown woolen coat and black Sunday hat, and the both of them, man and beast, blowing little clouds of steam on that frosty morn. He might have been a gallant knight of old. Tom Chaney rode his gray horse that was better suited to pulling a middle buster than carrying a rider. He had no handgun, but he carried his rifle slung across his back on a piece of cotton plow line. There is trash for you. He could have taken an old piece of harness and made a nice leather strap for it. That would have been too much trouble. Papa had right around $250 in his purse, as I had reason to know since I kept his books for him. Mama was never any good at sums, and she could hardly spell cat. I do not boast of my own gifts in that direction. Figures and letters are not everything. Like Martha, I have always been agitated and troubled by the cares of the day, but my mother had a serene and loving heart. She was like Mary and had chosen that good part. The two gold pieces that Papa carried concealed in his clothes were a marriage gift from my grandfather Sperling in Monterey, California. Little did Papa realize that morning that he was never to see us or hold us again, nor would he ever again hearken to the meadowlarks of Yale County trilling a joyous anthem to spring. The news came like a thunderclap. Here is what happened. Papa and Tom Chaney arrived in Fort Smith and took a room at the Monarch boarding house. They called on Stonehill at his stock barn and looked over the ponies. It fell out there was not a mare in the lot, or a stallion for that matter. The Texas cowboys rode nothing but geldings for some cowboy reason of their own, and you can imagine they are no good for breeding purposes. But Papa was not to be turned back. He was determined to own some of those little brutes, and on the second day he bought four of them for $100 even, bringing Stonehill down from his asking price of $140. It was a good enough buy. They made plans to leave the next morning. That night, Tom Chaney went to a bar room and got into a game of cards with some riffraff like himself and lost his wages. He did not take the loss like a man, but went back to the room at the boarding house and sulled up like a possum. He had a bottle of whiskey, and he drank that. Papa was sitting in the parlor talking to some drummers. By and by, Chaney came out of the bedroom with his rifle. He said he had been cheated and was going back to the bar room and get his money. Papa said that if he had been cheated, then they'd best go talk to the law about it. Chaney would not listen. Papa followed him outside and told him to surrender the rifle as he was in no fit state to start a quarrel with a gun in his hand. My father was not armed at that time. Tom Chaney raised his rifle and shot him in the forehead, killing him instantly. There was no more provocation than that, and I tell it as it was told to me by the High Sheriff of Sebastian County. Some people might say, well, what business was it of Frank Ross to meddle? My answer is this. He was trying to do that short devil a good turn. Chaney was a tenant, and Papa felt responsibility. He was his brother's keeper. Does that answer your question? Now, the drummers did not rush out to grab Chaney or shoot him, but instead scattered like poultry, while Chaney took my father's purse from his warm body and ripped open the trouser band and took the gold pieces, too. I cannot say how he knew about them. When he finished his thieving, he raced to the end of the street and struck the night watchman at the stock barn a fierce blow to the mouth with his rifle stock, knocking him silly. He put a bridle on Papa's horse Judy and rode out bareback. Darkness swallowed him up. He might have taken the time to saddle the horse, or hitched up 3 spans of mules to a Concord stagecoach and smoked a pipe, as it seems no one in that city was after him. He had mistaken the drummers for men. The wicked flee when none pursueth. Lawyer Daggett had gone to Helena to try one of his steamboat suits, and so Yarnell and I rode the train to Fort Smith to see about Papa's body. I took around $100 expense money and wrote myself out a letter of identification and signed Lawyer Daggett's name to it and had Mama sign it as well. She was in bed. There were no seats to be had on the coaches. The reason for this was that there was to be a triple hanging at the federal courthouse in Fort Smith, and people from as far away as East Texas and North Louisiana were going up to see it. It was like an excursion trip. We rode in a colored coach, and Yarnell got us a trunk to sit on. When the conductor came through, he said, "Get that trunk out of the aisle, nigger." I replied to him in this way, "We will move the trunk, but there is no reason for you to be so hateful about it." He did not say anything to that, but went on taking tickets. He saw that I had brought to all the darkies' attention how little he was. We stood up all the way, but I was young and did not mind. On the way, we had a good lunch of spare ribs that Yarnell had brought along in a sack. I noticed that the houses in Fort Smith were numbered, but it was no city at all compared to Little Rock. I thought then, and still think, that Fort Smith ought to be in Oklahoma instead of Arkansas, though of course it was not Oklahoma across the river then, but the Indian Territory. They have that big, wide street there called Garrison Avenue, like places out in the West. The buildings are made of fieldstone, and all the windows need washing. I know many fine people live in Fort Smith, and they have one of the nation's most modern waterworks, but it does not look like it belongs in Arkansas to me. There was a jailer at the sheriff's office, and he said that we would have to talk to the city police or the high sheriff about the particulars of Papa's death. The sheriff had gone to the hanging. The undertaker was not open. He had left a notice on his door saying he would be back after the hanging. We went to the Monarch boarding house, but there was no one there except a poor old woman with cataracts on her eyes. She said that everybody had gone to the hanging but her. She would not let us in to see about Papa's traps. At the city police station, we found 2 officers, but they were having a fist fight and were not available for inquiries. Yarnell wanted to see the hanging, but he did not want me to go, so he said we should go back to the sheriff's office and wait there till everybody got back. I did not much care to see it, but I saw he wanted to. So I said no, we would go to the hanging, but I would not tell Mama about it. That was what he was worried about. The federal courthouse was up by the river on a little rise, and the big gallows was hard beside it. About 1,000 or more people and 50 or 60 dogs had gathered there to see the show. I believe a year or two later they put up a wall around the place, and you had to have a pass from the marshal's office to get in, but at this time it was open to the public. A noisy boy was going through the crowd, selling parched peanuts and fudge. Another one was selling hot tamales out of a bucket. This is a cornmeal tube filled with spicy meat that they eat in old Mexico. They are not bad. I had never seen one before. When we got there, the preliminaries were just about over. 2 white men and an Indian were standing up there on the platform with their hands tied behind them and the 3 nooses hanging loose beside their heads. They were all wearing new jeans and flannel shirts buttoned at the neck. The hangman was a thin, bearded man named George Malden. He was wearing 2 long pistols. He was a Yankee, and they say he would not hang a man who had been in the GAR. A marshal read the sentences, but his voice was low, and we could not make out what he was saying. We pushed up closer. A man with a Bible talked to each of the men for a minute. I took him for a preacher. He led them in singing, "Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound," and some people in the crowd joined in. Then Maldon put the nooses on their necks and tightened up the knots just the way he wanted them. He went to each man with a black hood and asked him if he had any last words before he put it on him. The first one was a white man, and he looked put out by it all, but not upset, as you might expect from a man in his desperate situation. He said, "Well, I killed the wrong man, and that is why I am here. If I had killed the man I meant to, I don't believe I would have been convicted. I see men out there in that crowd that is worse than me." The Indian was next, and he said, "I am ready. I have repented my sins, and soon I will be in heaven with Christ my Savior. Now I must die like a man." If you are like me, you probably think of Indians as heathens. But I will ask you to recall the thief on the cross. He was never baptized and never even heard of a catechism, and yet Christ himself promised him a place in heaven. The last one had a little speech ready. You could tell he had learned it by heart. He had long yellow hair. He was older than the other two, being around 30 years of age. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, my last thoughts are of my wife and my two dear little boys who are far away out on the Cimarron River. I don't know what is to become of them. I hope and pray that people will not slight them and compel them to go into low company on account of the disgrace I have brought them. You see what I have come to because of drink. I killed my best friend in a trifling quarrel over a pocket knife. I was drunk, and it could just as easily have been my brother. If I had received good instruction as a child, I would be with my family today and at peace with my neighbors. I hope and pray that all you parents in the sound of my voice will train up your children in the way they should go. Thank you. Goodbye, everyone." He was in tears, and I am not ashamed to own that I was, too. The man Maldon covered his head with the hood and went to his lever. Yarnell put a hand over my face, but I pushed it aside. I would see it all. With no more ado, Maldon sprung the trap, and the hinged doors fell open in the middle, and the three killers dropped to judgment with a bang. A noise went up from the crowd as though they had been struck a blow. The two white men gave no more signs of life. They spun slowly around on the tight, creaking ropes. The Indian jerked his legs and arms up and down in spasms. That was the bad part, and many in the crowd turned in revulsion and left in some haste, and we were among them. We were told that the Indian's neck had not been broken, as was the case with the other two, and that he swung there and strangled for more than a half hour before a doctor pronounced him dead and had him lowered. They say the Indian had lost weight in jail and was too light for a proper job. I have since learned that Judge Isaac Parker watched all his hangings from an upper window in the courthouse. I suppose he did this from a sense of duty. There is no knowing what is in a man's heart. Perhaps you can imagine how painful it was for us to go directly from that appalling scene to the undertaker's where my father lay dead. Nevertheless, it had to be done. I have never been one to flinch or crawfish when faced with an unpleasant task. The undertaker was an Irishman. He took Yarnell and me to a room at the back that was very dark, owing to the windows being painted green. The Irishman was courteous and sympathetic, but I did not much like the coffin he had placed Papa in. It was resting on three low stools and was made of pine planks that had not been cleanly dressed. Yarnell took off his hat. The Irishman said, "And is that the man?" He held a candle in his face. The body was wrapped in a white shroud. I said, "That is my father." I stood there looking at him. What a waste. Tom Cheney would pay for this. I would not rest easy until that Louisiana cur was roasting and screaming in hell. The Irishman said, "If you would like to kiss him, it will be all right." I said, "No, put the lid on it." We went to the man's office, and I signed some coroner's papers. The charge for the coffin and the embalming was something over $60. The shipping charge to Dardanelle was $9.50. Yarnell took me outside the office. He said, "Miss Maddie, that man trying to stick you." I said, "Well, we will not haggle with him." He said, "That is what he counted on." I said, "We will let it go." I paid the Irishman his money and got a receipt. I told Yarnell to stay with the coffin and see that it was loaded on the train with care and not handled roughly by some thoughtless railroad hand.